From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
A Russian official says Moscow has made the first delivery of the S-300 missile defense system to Iran. However, Russia's Deputy Prime Minister Dmitry Rogozin didn't specify how many missiles had already been delivered. Press TV's Bardi Ahonadar has more.
The delivery is part of an $800 million agreement signed between the two sides back in 2007. 3 years later, Russia suspended the delivery due to the UN sanctions on Iran over its nuclear program. That prompted Iran to file a complaint against the relevant Russian arms firm with the International Court of Arbitration in Geneva. Earlier, Iran's foreign ministry spokesperson Hossein Jabri Ansari said Tehran and Moscow have started implementing the first phase of the contract.
Well, I already said that the new agreements have been made in the two countries for putting this delayed contract into implementation. The date was postponed, actually. New agreements have been made, and they're going to be implemented. Now I'm informing the public that the first phase of this contract has already started, and on the basis of the timetable, the new one, by the end of the contract, the various phases will be completed.
Ansari was speaking during a press conference in Tehran. His remarks came amid reports that the first shipment of the Russian missile defense system had arrived in Iran. Voters in Syria will cast ballots Wednesday to elect members of the next parliament. The head of the highest judicial committee for elections said that all necessary preparations had been made, as Press TV's Mohammed Ali reports from Damascus.
Syrians will go to polling stations on Wednesday to elect new members of parliament. Over 7,000 electoral centers have been set up for voters to cast their ballots. Head of Syria's Higher Judicial Committee for Elections told Press TV that the country is all set for the vote.
The Higher Judicial Committee, along with subcommittees, has finished all preparations for the elections. We held a meeting and discussed possible obstacles and means to tackle them. We are fully prepared for the elections.
Over 3,500 candidates from all walks of life are competing for 250 seats in the People's Assembly in Syria. Some of them represent political parties, while others are independent. Firas hopes to win a seat to help Syrian youths resolve their problems.
It's important for youth to have representatives at parliament. They have suffered a lot from the current crisis, so I'm running in the elections to represent the youth. I focused on three problems in my campaign: housing, unemployment, and public transportation for the youth.
The candidates' electoral campaigns have focused on various ways to resolve economic problems. According to the general elections law, candidates have to stop campaigning 24 hours ahead of the voting.
Holding parliamentary elections in Syria after 5 years of a deadly war signals the Syrians' determination to decide their own future. It also shows that the Syrian government will not allow terrorist supporters to halt political life in Syria, and that it will continue facilitating a political solution along with fighting against terrorism. Hamad Ali, Press TV, Damascus.
Ukraine will have a new parliamentary coalition and a new government later this week, after Sunday's resignation by Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk. That followed months of political turmoil in the country, leaving many now wondering whether the new government will be able to tackle the crisis. Press TV's Lena Savchuk reports from Kiev.
The embattled Ukrainian premier Arseniy Yatsenyuk has announced his decision to step down in an attempt to resolve months-long political crisis in the country. The crisis has already paralyzed the government, freezing financial aid from the International Monetary Fund and other donors to Ukraine.
The political crisis in Ukraine was caused artificially. The desire to change one person blinded the politicians and paralyzed their will to real changes in the country.
Yatsenyuk's announcement cleared the way for the parliament speaker Volodymyr Groysman to replace him and form a new government. Many Ukrainians expect Groysman to raise their life standards, but many others believe that nothing will change.
He will not do anything. The system is not changing. Ukraine is ruled by our foreign friends. All instructions are coming from overseas and they do not need Ukraine.
With Petro Poroshenko's loyalist Groysman as the new prime minister, the president will receive more leverage on the government. However, experts say the new cabinet will have to deal with all the factors which led to Yatsenyuk's resignation, like the low ratings of authorities, economic crisis and conflict among the country's elites.
Taking into consideration the high level of Yatsenyuk's unpopularity, his resignation will cool down the social anger. Authorities will receive a break while Ukrainians will examine the new cabinet and new premier.
The political crisis started in Ukraine in February when smaller coalition parties split off after the parliament failed to pass a no-confidence vote to Yatsenyuk. After recruiting non-aligned deputies into their factions, president and former premier managed to form a new coalition with minimum required 226 deputies, yet the new two-party majority is quite a fragile one, raising doubts about its effectiveness and generating speculations that Ukraine might soon face another snap parliament elections. Leon Savchuk, Press TV, Kiev.
The president of Argentina, Mauricio Macri, was the only Latin American head of state mentioned in the Panama Papers. Macri said he did nothing wrong. Nevertheless, Argentinians hit the streets in protest in what could be the new president's first corruption scandal. Telesur's Luriana Ponce filed this report from Buenos Aires.
After the Panama Papers revealed President Mauricio Macri was part of two offshore companies located in tax havens, Argentina's general prosecutor Federico Delgado opened an investigation in order to prove whether or not Macri intentionally avoided declaring his participation in such companies to Argentina's tax authorities.
This demands an investigation in which the crime committed could be an aggravated tax evasion, because it could have been committed through a staging to avoid tax payments or money laundering. And when we say money laundering, we mean it comes from illegal origins. And we should remember the Macri Group already had been investigated years ago under the Menem presidency for contraband.
Only hours after the investigation on Macri became public, hundreds of Argentines gathered in the historic Plaza de Mayo Square to show their anger for what could become the first corruption scandal of the Macri administration.
This guy, the director of the Colón Theater, Darío Lo Pérfido, the mayor of Lanús, Néstor Grindetti, they are all corrupt. They all have accounts in Panama. How can they keep going like this?
Protesters also spoke up against regressive economic measures carried out by Macri, such as the increasing public transportation fares and gas and electricity bills.
The media complicity that Macri enjoys in this case is outrageous. We are struggling against a very strong enemy, and we have no allies.
Macri anticipated he would go to a civil court to prove he did not intentionally hide his involvement in the two offshore companies. However, Prosecutor Delgado said it would not affect his investigation, which will continue despite the president's statements. Laureano Ponce, Telesur, Buenos Aires.
Meanwhile, with about 90% of the vote counted, it appears that voters in Peru will see June's presidential runoff being between two right-wing candidates. For more on that, we spoke with Tony Solo via Skype from Managua, Nicaragua, Tuesday.
The election in Peru has been the main event, as it were, over the last few days, over the weekend. No surprises. In the first round, Keiko Fujimori has got about 39% of the vote, and the second-placed candidate, Pedro Pablo Kuczynski, has got about 22-23% of the vote. And the great left hope that some people thought had the chance of perhaps coming second, beating Pedro Pablo Kuczynski into third place, Veronica Mendoza, she ended up getting less than 20% of the vote. She still did very well.
Yeah, so this is the final. They got the results from the countryside because she was hoping to do well there, and that was...
Yeah, this is with something like over 90% of the vote counted.
Gotcha.
Okay, so there's no way that Veronica Mendoza can overtake Pedro Pablo Kuczynski now. But and that's and Keiko Fujimori, and she came first, but that doesn't mean a thing in Peruvian terms, because and she did very well on the first round in the last election, the previous presidential election, when she was standing against Ollanta Humala, who eventually won in the runoff. And so now in Peru, there'll be a runoff. And it's not by no means certain that Keiko Fujimori will do better than she did against Humala. She, and Humala won only by 2 or 3 or 4%. He didn't win by a huge margin back whenever it was, whenever the last election was, 2012. There's no surprise that Keiko Fujimori has done very well. And by the same token, there's no guarantee that she'll, by any means, that she'll win, that she's the favourite to win in the second round, which be the runoff is, I think it's scheduled for June the 5th. And so and the task that Fujimori has is to convince the people that didn't vote for her that, you know, they're better off voting for her than for Pedro Pablo Kuczynski. There's some similarity in the programs, because Pedro Pablo Kuczynski is a centre-right politician, but he doesn't have the baggage, much of the baggage that Keiko Fujimori has, being the daughter of the former dictator Alberto Fujimori.
The imprisoned former dictator.
Yeah, he's right. Still in jail, and she's actually said that should she win the presidency, she will not offer her father a pardon.
I mean, that's some. You talk about political, you know, placing the political above everything. But you know, exactly. I mean, Kuczynski does not have this baggage. Does not have basically people voting against him. He's sort of innocuous as far as that goes. So he will probably draw the same vote he drew. Plus, he will probably draw a good part of the vote that went to Mendoza, or those people will stay home. And then people looking at actually electing Fujimori may vote against her. So she does not have a walk, for sure.
No, she does not at all. And she's still got something like 12 or 13% to get under her belt in terms of voting support. And that's, you know, given the configuration of the vote in on Sunday, and the results show that the former president, Alejandro Toledo, got under 2%. The former president, Alan Garcia, got around 6%, something like that. Centrist kind of guy, Alfredo Batanea, also kind of center-right, he did it a little bit better. I think he got around 8% of the vote, something like that. But none of those voters are likely to vote for Keiko Fujimori.
Right.
And the great majority of those votes will go to Kuczynski, and my money's on Kuczynski, actually.
Yeah, I mean, it looks to me like if you look at the numbers you just read out, for example, that and the fact that Fujimori is in prison, it seems that there's a pretty strong either apathy or antipathy with respect to former presidents of the country. None of them are popular. I mean, Jimmy Carter running on the Peanut Party in this year's election would get more than 5% of the vote.
Right.
He's in his 90s.
Right.
And he wasn't that popular when he left office.
Right. So in Peru, what are the political options? And it's a kind of slightly more right-wing flavor or slightly less right-wing flavor. No, I know. At the moment, Peru over the last few years, during the commodity boom of the if one can call it that, when China in particular and the Asian economies in general were kind of hauling the world economy along, because growth was so anemic, production was so anemic in North America and Europe. And in those days, Peru did quite well because it has very good relationships. And I think it's got a free trade agreement with China. They have very close relationships with Japan because Peru has quite a large population of Japanese origin. And the in general, they had good relationships with the dynamic countries like South Korea.
Oh, well, I mean, yeah, Fujimori, you know, has Japanese heritage.
Right. Well, yeah. Exactly. Yeah, so, right. You know, and so, and they were doing. Peru's economy did quite well in terms of those relationships, and also built up a good commercial relationship with the United States and with the European Union. But what's happened over the last year or so is that its growth has dropped. And I'm not 100% sure of the figures, but I think they dropped from something like 6% to 2% growth, which is a very dramatic drop. Yeah. And that was part of the context of the election. And so part of the context of the election was Keiko Fujimori saying that vote for me, I'll make the economy more dynamic, I'll promote employment, and the other main plank in her electoral campaign was security, that she was the candidate who would guarantee security to the Peruvians and crack down on organized crime and the remnants of what they regard as terrorist groups in Peru. Pedro Kuczynski, but there's very little emphasis, and the main difference between Fujimori and Kuczynski is that there's much more emphasis on social programs in Kuczynski's program and less emphasis on social programs, and much more emphasis on promoting foreign investment and such similar neoliberal kind of free market economic measures that Keiko Fujimori is promoting. And that, of course, means in the Peruvian context, much more focus on attracting foreign mining interests, much more interest in promoting foreign investment in Peru's massive gas reserves. You know, and that same, and that was, she's saying that she'll do a better job at that than either the previous president Ollanta Humala did, or than Pedro Kuczynski did. And the thing that may be a factor that's negative for Kuczynski is that he was, and I think he was either a treasury or an economy minister, right, in the government around 2005-2006. I think that was Alan Garcia's government. So,
well, you know what's interesting about all that is, you see, in an environment of declining commodity prices, by the way, I mean, you know, these investments, quote unquote, that would be promoted by Fujimori are going to be bargains for investors at the moment. It depends on what happens, you know, with those prices going forward. But you have, you know, the same economic conditions facing the people in Peru that are facing people all over the world, and including in the United States, in one fashion or another. The different dynamics involved, but the same output, essentially. And yet you have a contest between, you know, the daughter of a dictator and essentially a guy who's a, you know, former economics minister who has his hands in this, two establishment candidates, and some rise for the you know, the social Democrat. And in the United States, you have even more expression of that with Sanders' campaign. Why, what's stunting the ability of the left to find expression in the electoral sphere in Peru? Because it seems like it's been dampened.
Yeah, and the... And it is paradoxical that Peru sits between Ecuador and Bolivia. They're two very progressive countries that have done much better, certainly in social terms, than the successive governments in Peru. So it's very, very unusual for the or paradoxical or enigmatic, if you like, that the Peruvian population persist in this very strong right-wing bias. And that when one looks at if you look at a similar country here in Central America, and Guatemala has a similar kind of bias, and that has to do with I'm by no means an expert on Peru, but I should imagine that it's very similar to the situation in Guatemala, where all through the colonial period, indigenous peoples in the structures of their self-governance, insofar as they were able to maintain them intact, created a relationship with the colonial power of live and let live. You leave us alone to some extent, and we'll, you know, we'll just get on with our own internal business. And that seems to have been the pattern also in Guatemala, because there in Guatemala you had indigenous groups that were subject to a vicious genocidal war all through the 80s. And despite that, the majority of the indigenous population in Guatemala tend to vote for the center right. And that's true in Peru as well. And of course in Peru you have the long legacy of the a decade of war between the Sendero Luminoso insurgents and the military in Peru that engaged in an extremely vicious campaign of repression and basically wiped out Sendero Luminoso. And also attacked Sendero Luminoso's social base.
You know, it sounds so, like what they did here. The way you're describing basically indigenousistans in Guatemala, for example, sounds like reservations in the United States. And then when an indigenous leadership begins to reorient policy, they exterminate them or negate them somehow. Like we have Leonard Peltier, for example, in prison for the last 40 years. The same dynamic and the same sort of strategy and tactics being employed.
Yeah, and to some extent, under certain circumstances, repression works. You know, and you can kind of create a kind of, you can make people psychological prisoners of their alleged impotence. Mm. You know, and of course that's very much look at what happened in Chile. And the dictatorship wiped out a whole generation of progressive activists.
That's right.
And subjected the ones they didn't kill to massive repression.
Yeah.
What is the result? What is the political result of that? The political result of that currently is Michelle Bachelet.
Which actually,
who was
her, you it know, could have been worse.
Her family were victims of the dictatorship.
Right.
Yeah. But that didn't lead her, that has led her to a kind of centrist social democrat position. You know, yet within the current Chilean political context, which is the legacy of the Pinochet dictatorship.
Well, I'm going to come back to the United States again. Because that's the situation that Malcolm X described, basically the black community in the United States, as an internal colony, and with Glenn Ford calls misleadership class that is, has been subjected to that same kind of re-education.
Yeah, and without being an expert by any means on Peru, I know very little about Peru, but it seems to me that kind of analysis is probably an accurate analysis of why for an explanation of why Peru hasn't generated more radical political movements than, for example, Ecuador and Bolivia. And of course, bear in mind that in Ecuador, among the opposition to Rafael Correa's movement are some of the most important indigenous peoples organizations in the country.
Yeah.
So perhaps it's a complete misreading of the, to suggest that indigenous equals progressive. You know?
Right. Yeah. No, it's
by no means the case, certainly in those countries.
And not just that. I have a friend here that I've worked with on a number of issues dealing with local housing and such, who is from Ecuador, who is indigenous, and opposes the government like vehemently. She calls me an apologist for Correa and such.
Right.
And but in almost every other way, she's extremely progressive. It's an interesting dynamic. All right, so let's take that same mindset and go to Argentina. And what's going on there?
Yes, I'm in Argentina, and there was I put it up on our site today. There was a very telling letter from Milagro Sala, Argentina's latest political prisoner, and she's a member of the Mercosur Parliament. The Mercosur is the bloc of it's an economic framework mostly, but it has a political structure as well of Brazil, Paraguay, Uruguay, and Argentina. Milagro Sala is a radical trade union oriented, community oriented, grassroots activist oriented person with decades of trajectory working at grassroots, and very strong. Political personality, and she was at the head of the demonstrations against Mauricio Macri's massive round of
layoffs.
Of public sector workers. And as a result of her protests, Macri's repressive security forces and their buddies in the judiciary framed up Milagro Sala on bogus charges of causing public disorder or whatever the pretext was.
Right.
And she's currently in jail.
Mm.
And she published a letter to Cristina Kirchner, who's currently under attack in a very similar way to Dilma Rousseff,
right,
in Argentina, on totally spurious charges. I mean, what the judge that Mauricio Macri and his right wing mates have the judge that they found to kind of serve as the channel for attacking Cristina Kirchner. He's alleging that a futures transaction by Argentina's central bank sometime last year for buying dollars on the future market amounted to fraud because the price of the dollar actually fell and therefore cost the Argentinian treasury a certain amount of money. I don't know how many millions of dollars it was supposed to be.
Right.
But on that basis, and almost all of Wall Street should be behind bars.
Yeah, well, I think they should anyway.
For carrying out futures transactions, which actually turn out against them, you know?
Right, for
and
losing,
so,
when they gamble for losing. You know, a nation state that has a currency does this. They they not only make that bet, they hedge it with another bet and another bet and another bet. And to even know what happened, you have to look at the totality of those transactions. But in any event, unless she had some personal stake in it, I don't understand the criminality.
No, it was a central bank operation authorized by the government. And so, you know, and the buck stops at the president, doesn't
right.
it?
Well,
but
yeah.
To suggest that there's no question that she personally gained from it.
Right.
You know, and in the same way that, and it's like in the way these cases are projected in North America and in Europe is so dishonest and vague. For example, take the case against Dilma Rousseff. This week she'll face a vote in the full legislature of the full lower house of the legislature. Involving 513 deputies about whether or not the impeachment process that has been instigated against her should continue, right?
Right.
Now, if you read about that in the North American and European media, that is portrayed as Dilma Rousseff somehow being investigated for her part in the Petrobras scandal, but it's got absolutely nothing to do with the Petrobras scandal. Again, it's to do with some budgetary maneuvers that took place in 2014-2015 to enable the Brazilian government to cover the costs of its zero hunger program, of its programs to reduce extreme poverty.
Right.
But you'd never know that reading Western media. And so it's a toss-up at the moment. Will Dilma Rousseff get enough votes in the to support her as president in the vote that's likely to be held this week, to avoid the impeachment process moving to its next stage, which will be a consideration of the move of the procedure in the Brazilian Senate. So let's see what happens about that in Brazil.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.